Joining us now, she is the author and photographer for The Golf Kitchen. Diana DeLucia joins us. Welcome in, Diana.
Hi, how are you on this Saturday morning?
Yeah, it's awesome. Well, good morning, and thank you for joining us. We are... We typically try to find people in niches that have come up with something innovative about golf, and you know, it's easy to just profile the big manufacturers and things like that. And we stumbled upon your book and found it fascinating. Also found it to be one of the most beautifully produced works, in particular, I've ever seen. And I think many of our listeners know I come out of print media. This is much more than a recipe book. This is not a cookbook. It is a coffee table book, and it is beautiful. So congratulations on that. I'm looking at this, and what I see is you. Tell me if I'm wrong. There's a, you know, we've started profiling chefs. We see guys like Mario Batali and Bobby Flay have become stars in the last decade. And you decided to go out and profile some of the finest golf courses in the world, but also their chefs and signature dishes. How did this come about, and why was there a need that needed to be addressed?
Well, that's a good question. When I moved to the United States in the early 2000s, my then partner and I, we started a magazine in New York City because I was intrigued by the whole dining industry, and I was a photographer, and we began a magazine by accident, really. It was became like a hobby at the start, and we ran it for about 5 years, and all we did was cover fine dining chefs and put them on the cover. And it was, you know, it was a small little magazine, but it became quite popular. And I was fascinated by it, and I discovered how good I was at food photography, and I put that into my, you know, repertoire, and I gained a reputation for it. It's just something that comes naturally. And then when the recession hit, we closed the magazine, Restaurant Insider, and I wanted to cover... I had always wanted to write a book, so I wanted to cover food in another area that wasn't being illuminated. So I found the golf industry, and I produced my first book surrounding, and it had food in it, and surrounding industry figures that make golf happen. And I traveled globally for that, and that was called Golf Club World. It was a lot of work, and the result was beautiful as well. And then I found that the people were really interested in the food side of the golf clubs, and particularly the private golf clubs, in the first book. And that was when the idea of Golf Kitchen came about, was to create more of a chef and recipe-centric book. And that's how it happened.
Yeah, and you take us on a gastronomic tour of the world: Vietnam, the UAE, Spain, Morocco, Ireland, Dominican Republic, Australia, and then closer to home, some of the courses that our listeners will be, or the clubs that our listeners will be familiar with: the Greenbrier, Sabonic, Bay Hill, Old Waverly, even Kiawah Island, the Tradition, and Winged Foot. What have you found generally when you look at the cuisine that's offered at these private clubs and the chef's willingness to maybe take chances? I mean, they've got a captive audience with a membership base that they need to keep happy. Are they reluctant to take chances? Are the customers, do they tend to be the people receptive to different foods? I mean, what did you find in exploring them? It's way more than loaded potato skins and chicken wings.
Well, I think the chefs in the private club industry, and in general, especially when there's a membership, they do... The membership in most of the clubs that I've been in with this project, Golf Kitchen, they already have like an extremely intelligent palate, they would say, in the culinary industry. They've traveled the world. They've eaten at the finest restaurants. So they know what fine food is and what fine cuisine is. And they also, you know, they know their products and they know their wines. So they're very supportive of the chefs on a whole. You know, they have their favorites, and they tend to keep their favorites. And a lot of the time, you know, the chef will show them something different, and if the members like it, then they'll put that on the menu. And on a whole, I do believe in the private club industry, they're very supportive from what I've seen of their chefs being innovative, but with keeping it within what the members want. You know, they're not going to go so far, you know, off the beaten path of something. You know, that would not make sense. And if they were going to introduce it, they would do it slowly.
So what would be the appeal for a chef, though, to go and join the staff at a private club over, say, you know, a five-star restaurant in New York City or Las Vegas, or what's the upside for the chef to be at a private club?
I think there's a lot of upsides for a chef in private club industry. They have a bigger budget, so they're able to source better products. I mean, they're very spoiled on where products come from, and they're able to create a lot more items as well, menu items. They can change them more often. I mean, unless you're like one of the high-end fine dining chains that is doing really, really successfully well. I mean, their bottom line is not, you know, they have a little bit more freedom with product choice.
Yep.
And you'll notice that is one of the common things the chefs do talk about working in the private club industry, is being able to have that luxury of having excellent products.
And, you know, Mike talked about earlier that this was a coffee table book. My issue would be I'd have to take pictures of the recipes and then print them off on the printer, just so I don't like
don't
have
make it messy.
Well,
right.
So I don't get it stained, because all my cookbooks have stains, and you know I know this isn't just a cookbook, but I mean there's great recipes inside of here. How does one get to be like your designated taster and get to go to all these places and eat all this great looking food?
That I couldn't tell you the answer to.
Okay, I'm applying now.
Yeah. I mean, just the travel alone, even if you know.
Well, I mean, maybe I could go play the golf courses as well and then come back and eat the food.
There you go.
See, I'm thinking from a two-point perspective.
Well, I think that sounds like
I
a good...
I used to have an idea that we'd have a competition.
Right. I like that.
And it would be, the competition would be sponsored by some company, and then people could come and play golf and then do the food photography and travel everywhere on the next project.
This is like I sense a Golf Channel show coming up. The golf
Ooh.
The golf kitchen.
Golf food, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really interested. I'm actually pursuing an idea and vision at the moment, and hopefully it'll come to fruition. But we're working really hard to try to make that happen, and we'll see. It depends how much support we get within the industry, but there's a lot of interest at the moment in Golf Kitchen, and, you know, I'm really proud of it, and I'm really proud of all the chefs and the clubs that took the time to be a part of the project. They're a bunch of really passionate people.
Well, and looking at some of the recipes that are available in the book, some of them, it's kind of funny. You've got from Kiawah Island their famous four-cheese macaroni, which Mark and I both
had. Yes.
Their huckleberry pie. You've got out at Bay Hill, you've got their chicken pot pie. Were the chefs ever reluctant to sort of peel back the curtain and show you how these things were? I mean, these are dishes that people who sit and eat them go, oh man, I wish I could make this, but there's no way I could. And now all of a sudden, all the layers have been peeled back, and they could give it a shot if they want to. Were they reluctant
exactly.
to give you the? Were they reluctant to give you the launch codes?
And it's surprising, because that chicken pot pie is, out of the entire recipe book, I would have to say one of the most popular recipes.
Oh, that's funny. Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, it's amazing, but it's probably something that people feel they can tackle, which might be easier than, say, seared kangaroo loin. I'm not sure where I would get my kangaroo loin here in Charlotte, but what would be a suitable substitute for kangaroo loin?
Venison, they tell me.
Okay. We can get that.
Yeah, so you would substitute it with venison.
You mean I can't go to Outback Steakhouse? They don't have kangaroo there?
No, not at the Outback.
I don't think so. I don't even think so.
No, we can get some venison on my street. There's so many deers walking across. That'd be easy. We can do that. We can do that. So when you start dealing with clubs did you find that around the world that different clubs have sort of a different vibe and they stick with that? I mean, I know some places are very, very particular and take great pride in using locally sourced products, and then there are other parts of the world where there are no locally sourced products, so they have to go around the world and get them. Did you find in your tour of these courses that each course has its own, its own vibe, its own culture, and that they try to stay within that to make sure they're continuing to satisfy their membership base?
Every single place I went to has its own culture, you're correct. And that's the beauty of it. It's like you were mentioning about, you know, the farm-to-table concept is very popular and rightfully so. But if you go somewhere like Dubai where they don't grow anything, they have to source everything from other countries. And they're doing a very good job of it as well. They have, I think, six or seven huge huge distribution centers, and they have the ability to get product from anywhere in the world. I actually visited one when I was at Emirates Golf Club, and they showed me how everything comes into the country, and it was absolutely fascinating.
Again, we're talking with Diana DeLucia from the Golf Kitchen, and if you want to check them out online, www.golfkitchen.com. There are a few recipes out there. I'm looking at the Brant beef short rib recipe right now, and I'm wondering when somebody's going to come cook this for me tonight. So you can order the book out there. And it's a great book. Mike's thumbing through it right now. What else you got there, Mike?
I love this book. It's hard. Promoting a book on the radio is very difficult, especially a book like this that is so hinged on the visual. It is just, I'm thumbing through it, and I'm looking at something like, for example, I think from Spain you have a lobster salad. How different is lobster salad in Spain than in Maine, where I'm from? Is the lobster flavor different?
It's not so much the lobster salad is dramatically different. It's a different product. So they're sourcing different products, and different products taste different in different countries. It's just like wine.
Yeah, so you're getting some, this is not your cold water, North Atlantic lobster. This is lobster that they're sourcing from someplace nearer by and might have a little different taste.
It might be hanging. Yeah, it's hanging out on the beach.
Straight.
it's beach lobster.
The products are all different. Like a lobster tastes different in Italy than it does in Australia or Indonesia.
Well, with the Masters coming up, what kind of wine would we pair with egg salad? That's a signature dish at when people go to the Masters. What would you drink with egg salad?
Now, that's not my expertise. I'd have to bring in a sommelier for that one.
Yeah, there's probably it's probably a beer, a Diet Coke or something. I don't know what people are having
salad
down there.
I'm not sure where I'd go with that one. I don't know if I'd have wine with an egg salad.
No.
Maybe. No. In the morning, maybe you could have Prosecco.
There you go.
So you could have Prosecco, or you could, have a little cocktail with Prosecco with orange juice or something like that.
So now, before we let you go, what was the surprise? I mean, anytime you're putting together a book like this, and I remember, you come out with it, you have an idea, and you're starting to put it together, and then there's sometimes a little curveball or maybe a fork in the road that changes things a bit. What was the surprise for you in putting this together when you were looking at these private clubs, their chefs, and their recipes?
The surprise for me, I wouldn't say surprised. I was really impressed with the quality of chefs in the private club industry, and they want to, they don't get how all the chefs, and sorry for stumbling, the chefs in the culinary world outside of the club industry and the restaurant industry, are getting a lot of airtime. And I feel like some of these chefs are better and more creative than a lot of the restaurant chefs getting airtime. And I really feel it was time to highlight the chefs in the club industry because they are just as good and if not better.
Well, and you've got a partnership with Pin High Spirits, really a vodka company. And I like that their advertisement in your book features a left-handed golf club. I guess lefties drink more than righties. could you have done this book without the support of people like them?
Pin High has been fabulous. They're a great company. I actually am interviewing Jeff Gringrod for the Golf Kitchen next week.
Nice.
Awesome.
So we'll read all about the story behind Pin High.
Well, Diana, we appreciate you coming on. And again, I remind everybody, www.golfkitchen.com for great recipes, more information to be able to buy the book. And, like I said, give me a call when you need somebody to go play golf and taste the food for this show that you're going to come up
book,
with.
The book is amazing. I would encourage everybody to check it out. Lift with your legs. It's very, very heavy.
It is quite heavy, isn't it? I appreciate you guys having me on the show, and I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you again soon.